I do have to share with you guys. I was talking about this earlier. I met both of you last year at Pinch, like right before the
pandemic happened.
Right before. Right before it. And I was on the brink of just honestly leaving this part of the industry. I was just in a job that I was not very happy with. Mm-hmm. It was just rough. And you guys gave me like the pep talk of my life without even realizing it.
What? What the fuck?
It was somebody's birthday.
Like, you sure it wasn't some other white dudes? I don't think it was us.
But I mean, you what you said was like, hey, we love all the bells and whistles and we love what we love. But at the end of the day, Pinot Grigio pays my bills, baby. Like, you got to hustle. And it just clicked. Like, you know what? You're right. Like, all these things are romantic and it's really fun. But like, if I'm really going to make this a career, I have to look at the business aspect of it and I have to really drive it and layer it in. And for some reason, like, it was fuel in my tank, you know?
That is amazing.
That doesn't sound like anything we say.
All I can think is that Miguel had given us like some very, very strong drinks at the beginning of that night.
And I think we were blacking out.
There were just some kind of spirits coming. Like, we were just a vessel, I think, in that moment. But I'm glad that we were there at that time.
I'm trying to think of what other advice we gave that night. It was like, fucking drink it.
Oh, it was great. It was great. And I'm really grateful for it because I love my position right now. I love like the life I live right now. And I think I'd be miserable if I would have taken that restaurant director position. Close to going back to restaurants.
Hey, you're welcome.
I've had to give myself that talk like 7 times a week, basically, where you're just like, why do I do this again? And you're like, oh, right. Okay. Like, I do love it, but also I have to treat it like a business. I can't just have fun all the time. I actually have to like do work, which I hate to do, but I'll do it.
Do work.
And then once you put the work in and you do the hustle, it's like, then you have the free time to enjoy the parts you enjoy, you know?
Well, you also reinforced what I knew, but like coming from people who I see as successful and I see, you know, thriving in this space, accept it, take it, is that like you have to put your 2 years in.
Yeah.
And after those 2 years, things just kind of open up and you feel a little bit more secure, accepted, confident, whatever it may be. But before those 2 years, if you just kind of tap out, you're almost cheating the work that you've laid down. Like, it doesn't have the chance to come to fruition, you know?
The pep talk I was given when I was thinking about being, maybe I told you this that night, I don't even remember, because that feels like 100 years ago. But like, this guy said to me, I was like, I think I might become a rep. He was like, great. He's like, you'd be good at it. He's like, it's going to be the hardest thing you've ever done for like a year and a half. And then it's going to be like pretty hard for a year. And then if you get past those two steps, it's like, then it'll start being like, not easy, but you'll be able to do it and it'll like pay off. And I was like, all right, I guess I can do that.
When I was thinking about being a rep, Kevin looked me in the eyes dead on and said, you'll probably make $70,000 to $80,000 the first year very easily. And then from there on, like, the sky's the limit. And like, I remember you Kevin was my boss for a while.
That was a huge lie.
Bold-facedly lying to me.
Start like
I was selling cider and Kevin and this motherfucker had me in a room. They were sitting like 15 to 20 feet away from me. I was in a chair in the middle of this bare office. And they're like, we're not going to lie. Like, you know, a lot of the accounts could be taking over. They're going to need some push. But with them, we easily see these these ones will be picking up like 50K a month. No problem. And like, I can really see you going places. And I was like, oh, gee, sir, thanks. And I'll never forgive Kevin for that.
Whoops.
Yep. I was going to be a general manager of a wine store. I had that job offer in my back pocket. And I was like, no, actually, we'll do this instead.
You got back at me by making me do this podcast.
That's true.
It's like fair.
Yeah, we ruin each other's life. It's great.
It's gorgeous.
Hi. Welcome to Disgorgeous. It's a podcast about wine. I'm John. I'm Duck.
Oh, wow. Hi, I'm the dumb one. Our guest today, Jade, Marley, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today, even though your car didn't want you to.
Thank you guys for having me. Great.
Mm-hmm. We're doing a month of, I guess the theme is old wine, or the idea of age and wine through a bunch of different contexts. And so for this episode, we're kind of focusing on it through the prism of rosé, which I'm super excited about because I think it's something that is both like sort of like a, it's like a microcosm of wine in general, where we can talk about a lot of different ideas, which is just like, what is color in wine, but also like, why do we age wine and why are there rules about aging wine? Like all this kind of stuff just floats around this idea.
And I also, I think we, the big elephant in the room with this is, of course, is that rosé is generally, for a lot of producers, their worst grapes, and it's made for quick sale. And I don't think that applies to the wines we're tasting today. So, and I think what I if I could sum up the thesis statement of this episode, which I never do because it never works, it's that if you just think about rosé like wine, then like it becomes much more of an interesting category. So I, hopefully, I don't want to spoiler everything. Hopefully, the data will demonstrate that thesis.
yeah. So first, we're drinking the Vetter Spätburgunder Rosé 2018, which we almost did in the Germany season, but we didn't. Thankfully, because now we're doing it now.
Yeah, I love this wine. So I've had a huge crush on this wine for this is my second vintage of buying a lot of it. A lot of it, as much of it as I can get. Vetter is like a winemaker I've had a little bit of a crush on. I try to bring his stuff onto podcasts whenever we can. And right before the pandemic, I bought every single bottle I could find. So I think I bought like four bottles of his 2017 rosé, and I just pounded them. And then the 2018, I could only find one bottle. I had to buy it directly from Von Boden. This was, of course, for our season about November. But I just love this wine, and it's I've been waiting to put it in something. The 2018, I believe, is the current release, but I did see 2019s already floating around at some stores. So I think just the answer is there's never any of this wine, like 10 to 20 cases at a time in the U.S.
Right. Jade, can we talk about your kind of history and like where you got to where you are now in wine and what your kind of journey was? I think it's a good way to like segue into maybe your relationship with rosé in general. Because I think everyone's relationship to it is kind of marked by whether they came in through retail or they came in through restaurants, like those two approaches to rosé.
How long have you been selling wine? Have you had to do like the rosé cattle call?
Yes. Every, what is it, like February into March up until like June? 100%. Yes.
We love it.
And then they just sell off what they haven't sold through July and August, and it's a desert. Yes, yes, yes. So I am a hospitality baby. Okay. My first job was as like a prep cook and dishwasher at a summer stock theater up in the Catskills, where I'm from.
And where in the Catskills are you from?
Monticello.
Okay, it's cool.
Where I grew up. I was born in Queens, moved up there when I was around 3, and then moved out when I was 18. But
okay, cool.
Lots of my life spent up there in the mountains, in the woods. Mm-hmm. And yeah, hospitality just, that was it. And I worked my way from, you know, kind of prep cooking into being a diner waitress. Mm-hmm. And let me tell you about hustle. nobody hustles like a diner server. I mean, sides, there's no runner. You're lifting up 30-pound trays and, you know, doing your thing.
And like a full breakfast costs $1.89. So you're like getting like 7 cents tips on stuff.
For nothing. But I will say, I think it primed me for my bar experience, because that counter where you pour those coffees and you cut that muffin with the little jam and you serve your regulars that come in every single day. That's bartending. That's psychology is bartending, just a different product, you know?
Yeah.
So from there, when I turned 18, I started bartending. I convinced somebody to let me sling drinks behind the bar, and I continued doing that through college. I probably took away from my studies quite a bit. But it's just where my interests lie, you know, it's also where my social life, was happening. And I did that for quite some time until I realized like my interviews just weren't going well. I was really kind of pigeonholed into working at Applebee's, working at like kind of off the beaten path lounges, working at dive bars, working at really classic like Italian restaurants. But I wanted to make like, I love flavor. I love complexity. And I wanted to be on that scene. I wanted to be taken seriously. So wine has certifications. And I knew that with 10 plus years in hospitality, you know, layered with an actual certification, there wasn't a white man that could tell me I couldn't work their program because I wasn't qualified. Mm-hmm. And that's what I needed to work against, is I felt like there was a lot of gatekeeping going on. So,
in
you know,
wine?
In everything.
You know cut her mic. That's insane.
So, I mean, really, like, there's a lot of talk around, oh, should you test? Should you not test? Don't test. It's this. There's no typicity. Mm-hmm. There's no correct. That's really easy to say when you have a network that you can lean into and get job placement. It's not the same for all of us. And I had all this experience under my belt and couldn't land a fucking job. But a week after I got my CMS certification, I was a sommelier at a new restaurant. Lamico on 6th Avenue in Manhattan.
Shout out, cool.
Is the best. He was my first entry into wine, still remains a mentor of mine and just an amazing person. And I fell in love with Italian wine because I had to. Indigenous grape varietals are fucking hard.
Yeah.
And I was working with a very stush clientele and I knew I had to be on my shit. And that's really how I got into wine. I stayed there for about 3 years. I toured Italy quite a few times. I got really, really deep Italian varietals. And I was actually having this conversation the other day that, like, the deeper you get into a region, if you're not trying to drop a whole bag, you usually wind up in this natural wine space. You wind up with these smaller production, more artisan focused wines because they're the best. Unless you're trying to drop a bag, at which case there are some really good
producers
you can tap into, but I can't afford that shit. So that was kind of my entryway into this. I felt a little isolated on the restaurant side, as it happens. You're kind of, you know, confined to those four walls. And I wanted to see, and I think this still is reflected in my work now, I wanted to see what the wine world and beverage world had to offer beyond a sales pitch. I wanted to see what went down outside of the marketing, outside of the sales pitch. So I went to that stage to see what goes into it. And that's where I'm at now.
So here's my follow-up question with regards to rosé, because I think there's so much that we need to, like, sort of just, like, state at the beginning of this conversation, just so we all are building off the same idea. But rosé has all of these preconceived notions. And it differs a little bit, I think, if you're in maybe a more wine-focused restaurant like Mika, especially with, like, an Italian focus. And
Italian rosés are good.
Yeah, and they're probably not looking for the most recent rosé necessarily if they're drinking one, versus if you're in a retail shop where it's like, if it's not the most recent rosé, I'm not going to buy it unless it's on Wicked Closeout. And now that you've become on the sales side, you understand that kind of dichotomy too. But I think, like, we have to sort of unpack, like, what are the basic ideas of rosé for the consumer as they're coming into it? Like, when you were working at Lamica, was there a desire for rosé in this space? Were you selling a lot of rosé there? Were you kind of experiencing it day to day?
So, yes, I think Lamico is really unique in its location. You get a lot of what people would call bridge and tunnel folks.
Okay.
Because it is right up the block from Madison Square Garden. It's like the easiest spot to sit down and eat in relation to that. And then you also have people that come in because the wine list is geeky as hell and there's a notable chef and you get a lot of that scene too. So we got people of all different interest levels when it comes to wine. We had a very thin, structured Pinot Nero from Lombardia on the list year round. And it was probably one of our top sellers because that's what people wanted. A very thin kind of, like, I don't have to think about it, goes with the tuna crudo, cool kind of rosé. Yeah. We also had inky as shit rosé from, like, down in Puglia that, you know, nowadays we would call a light red because it's all about skin contact, right? With contact and all of these things that people would also geek on and be like, ooh, I can drink this rosé with, like, a thin cut of meat and it would be okay. Let me get some mushrooms, you know? So we got
a
little
bit. Do you remember pairing? Jesus Christ.
So I'm a pairing geek, y'all. I know there's a lot of conversation going on about it. I love food. I'm here because I love food. I'm here because I love flavor interaction and I'm unapologetic about it. Like, I drink a wine, I get inspired, and then I go cook a meal. I'm not going to go cook a meal that clashes with it. I'm going to cook the meal that I'm inspired by.
I always reverse that. I always make the meal and then I'm like, and then I'm struggling to find the wine that I happen to have that will go well with it. But maybe I should reverse that.
I live with a dog, So, like, whenever I'm eating, she's just looking at me the whole time. Just she sits. She has a little table near my table where she sits, so she can look at me. And I it's so hard to enjoy a fucking meal because she's just like, you know, I love ravioli too, man. Let's see if we can work something out here. Maybe I'll lay down if you give me some ravioli. So, like, the idea of sitting and, like, I make food, I eat in about 32 seconds, and then I drink a bottle of wine on the couch. It's a really good life.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm.
Not cheers.
Okay, to come back to Rosé a little bit, like, here's what I'm thinking. Like, in the restaurant space, like you sort of alluded to, like, often when people are reaching for a rosé and they're, you know, if they're at the bar, they're having small bites or something like that. They really are saying, I want something light, thin. I don't have to think about it. Mm-hmm. And that's been this like lane that rosé has done quite well for itself in the last, I mean, I want to say 50, I mean, at least since what, the 70s, the 80s, like they've, mm-hmm. it's found this lane. And you know, it's definitely been a boon to the people who make a lot of flavorless rosé, but it's been this really insane, I don't know, this insane like albatross or something that like that just like has weighed down this whole idea of drinking good rosé. Like to try to convince someone that they're going to enjoy drinking rosé sometimes can be like the most impossible fucking thing in the world.
And the marketing, of course, is so fucked up. Like I remember a couple years ago the brosé moment. Mm-hmm. When like you know, white dudes of a certain vest level would like walk into wine stores like, yeah, bro, I'll have a rosé. Like I don't even care who's listening. I fucking love it. You know, like you know,
ew.
Even if, that's not me. No, that's not me. I wait until a girl sees me pick up a bottle of rosé. I'm like, oh yeah, I have that in my house. I live near here, and then I start blushing and I start crying and I get a nosebleed. But like, you know, it's the same vibe.
Those are like the cousins of the people who are like, y'all take a Cosmo and a rocks mm-hmm. glass, mm-hmm. you know?
Like, yeah.
It's like, I guess it's like, it doesn't faze me.
It's so bizarre. Like the psychology of what has like, there's a psychology of like the dudes who don't even think they can drink white wine. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
I love those dudes. But like then, the Californians. Like,
but then you don't like, but then like the rosé thing, just simply because it's pink, will like melt certain dudes' brains because they're like, well, I can't drink a thing that's pink because I've been taught about these gender ideals since I was born that aren't even real. That like just totally melt people's like ability to enjoy something that's delicious. And it's so fucking strange. And I just wonder if rosé wasn't pink, like, if it was on a different color spectrum altogether, if it would even be this. I mean, I guess it would be orange wine.
If they invented it tomorrow and they called it, like, what's a, like, ruby wine or something, like you know, the analog to amber wine, we'd have everyone would lose their fucking mind because it's great.
Yeah. Yes. I love that you just said that. So in the Eclecticon portfolio, we have this wonderful producer, Halkia, mm-hmm. from the Maya. She has this wine called Reddish. Mm-hmm. It was previously known as rosé. It was a healthier rosé, but it's so dank and dark. She's mm-hmm. calling it reddish. And she could easily call it a rosé. She could easily call it a red, but it's in this very like ambiguous area. And it really challenges like, okay, what defines a rosé? Like at what point do you draw that line in the sand and say, this is not a red. This is not worthy of attention and aging, so to speak. This
right.
is actually a rosé. Like how much does it have to do with that anthocyanin profile? Mm-hmm. How much does it have to do with like the lees contact? Like what's going on that makes it worthy, you know?
Right.
I think that the hard and fast rule for me in a lot of ways is mallow. Like if you let the wine go through mallow, because a lot of times, especially like Provence rosés, just don't, and you get that mm-hmm. fucking sharp. Mm. Like, you get it, it. It tastes like a nothing white wine. But like once you start letting it, like once you start making natural wine as a rosé, then you're throwing like you can do what the fuck you want. Which is again, I want to hop back to this one. I know that way we normally do this is the first wine is a sacrificial lamb. We don't start paying attention until we get to our third. But I am obsessed with this wine. And this was my only fucking bottle, so you guys have to like it.
Oh, I got rid of mine.
Amazing. This is beautiful. It's throwing on this like I don't say this in rosé very often, so I'm really excited. There's like this southern tea note going on where things are getting very herbal. Not mm-hmm. southern tea like sweet tea. I mean like a slow brewed, extracted, like mm-hmm. almost kind of twiggy thing that's just happening on the finish that I keep going back to, and it's just so unexpected.
I think that like sort of garrigue tea kind of herbaceous thing that happens with some rosés is possibly my favorite savory like thing that wine can do.
I love
I have a rosé from Sicily that I sell that is like, it's like one of my favorite wines. It's $10. It's like, so it's, you should buy some for me. It's so cheap, but it's like, it just tastes like, it just tastes like the herbs you buy all together to rub on your chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Like where they're like, you're like, which herbs are these? They're like, it's the chicken herbs. And you don't actually like, don't ask another question. It's like that. And you're just like, holy fuck, like a rosé can do this. Yeah. That's like, that's killer. I mean, this isn't quite that extreme, but.
Never had, I think, just the white Sylvaner. And classic, the German, yes?
Yes.
We have a ghost on this episode. Introduce yourself, spirit.
But no, I never had their pink, so super, super cool.
None of it ever exists. Last year, because of the pandemic, I was able to buy two bottles from Irving Bottle, one bottle from the Hi-Hi Room, and one bottle from Leon & Sons. This year, I was only able to get it because we bought wine directly from Von Boden at like the beginning of our November season.
We bothered him a lot. We annoyed him.
I haven't seen this on the shelf, and if you do see it, just fucking buy it. I love it, and also send it to me.
But there's a good thing, and maybe we'll talk about this later. But like, this is a really hard category for a lot of winemakers to sell wine in. If you're making rosé that is interesting.
$33.
Yeah,
which right there makes it not a rosé for a lot of people.
Right. Something else I've been thinking a lot about, and I'm sort of just spitting a lot of ideas out at once because I've had a lot of coffee today and I've been thinking about this for a while, is like the parallels between what happened with like the codified idea of rosé and what is or could happen with orange wine, which is like sort of having that moment right now.
Mm-hmm.
And like the idea that like how quickly an industry or the world or whatever can like see something and immediately be like, well, we have to define its parameters. Like mm-hmm. we cannot allow it to exist on a spectrum at all. We have to be like, well, it begins here and it ends there. Mm-hmm. And it's this thing that is happening with orange wine where I'm seeing the lines being drawn, and it's capitalism, it's commercial interests that are doing it, but saying, okay, people like orange wine if it's this kind of juicy mm-hmm. neon orange in a clear bottle idea. And so this is now going to become orange wine. And now when you're trying to sell something made in an amphora from, you know, Turkey, that mm-hmm. is like a real orange wine, the way it's been made for 2,000 years, people are going to be like, it's not really orange enough. And you're going to want to kill yourself. I
love that.
It's like... The actual real thing has now become the outlier against the kind of codified sellable version of it.
There's a very grad school take, which is the signifier has become the sign or whatever, but I don't really or like the long has become the parole. There's whoever's smarter than me just make that and say I said it, but there is like it's become so trapped in itself. Like I have to sell a bunch of orange wines that I sell as it's like kind of like a baby orange wine, which is not my opinion. It's just like, it's not really fucking dank and orange. It's like, well, yeah, because the winemakers know what they're fucking doing. And like this rosé, like, you know, just to go back to the wine, I think all the ones today, the idea for them would be like, they're not crushable. Like, and that, you know, time is the one thing that we're exploring this season. Is time's a thing in the winemaker's toolkit that almost never gets applied to fucking rosé. And there's almost no wonder that people don't like rosé because, like, we're tasting it now. Like, people are asking me for fucking tank samples right now. And I'm like, no, I don't want to see you to taste real wine.
Right.
And it's like, you know, the people buy wine based off the fucking label. They sell it based off the label. And by the time it gets good, like the 2020 rosés are going to be really good October or November. Mm-hmm. They're gone. They're sold out.
Let the middle fill out a little bit. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Kevin, something that you said just, I mean, and I have to take the bait and I have to say it, like, who do we allow to define what from where? Who is saying that this Turkish orange wine, Turkish amber wine, whatever it may be, that's been made forever, does not qualify or does not fit into your definition? Like, who sets these terms? You know what I mean? And I think, you know, as much as, yes, we want to find a baseline and we want to find commonalities between wine, each region is its own thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have our own cuisines. We all have our own practices and traditions. And like, I was selling rosé wine from Georgia that was inky and red. I mean, red. But in comparison to what their most extracted wines are, it was fucking rosé.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? So it really kind of started to get the wheels turning. Like, oh no, we can't treat this as such a broad subject. We really have to look at these things in relation to the cultures that they're coming from on the spectrum from what the country produces. I mean, we can say the same thing about like Verdicchio. Verdicchio typically sees some skin contacts, typically sees some lees. I mean, it gets like the orange wine treatment. It's not an orange wine.
Right.
It's classic Verdicchio that they drink as white wine. And, you know, that's just what it is. So, yeah, I think just honoring the regions and the cultures that the wines are from, rather than trying to hop behind these marketing schemes, just go a lot farther, a lot deeper, leave more room for nuance.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I feel like what you just said there kind of bears repeating is that wine's only rosé in comparison to the red. Like,
right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's... I don't know what Vetter's Red is. I've never seen one of Vetter's. I think I'm sure he does a Spätburgunder Red, but I've never seen that anywhere. I'd be interested to taste it. I imagine it's not much darker than this, to be honest.
Yeah, I guess to amplify your point, like what I was saying was very much this sort of cynical, kale you can find yourself in sometimes in this industry, where you're like, why do I keep having to have this conversation over and over again with people of being like, no, this is his rosé. I don't know what to tell you. Like, it only had a day of skin contact, but it's red as fuck. I mean, and it's just when you start to think about like the cyclical nature of what people, how people drink wine and what they look for in wine, and whether it's claret or if it's, you know, the way that all red wine was basically rosé when it was first made, and all white wine was basically orange wine when it was first made. Mm-hmm. It was only in, you know, more modern times, quote unquote, that we started to push those ideas to the farther ends of each other. Like, and then the idea of, you know, white Zinfandel becoming, or blush becoming this thing in the 70s and becoming associated with sweet wine. And then like a sweet wine movement happening, which it seems to happen every like 50 or 60 years or something. It's just like, sometimes I look at it all from this macro view and it's like exhausting that I'm like, oh man, I sometimes feel like we're on this hamster wheel of just like, we have to have this conversation, we have to have this conversation. But maybe that's just the nature of loving something too much and making your livelihood out of something that you care about instead of just like stamping a piece of paper every day. I don't know.
The people who don't care are much happier in wine.
Yeah. No doubt. Yeah.
I've moved on to wine number two, which is interesting. This is wine number one is a 2018 Spätburgunder. And wine number two is a 2017 Pinot Noir Rosé from the Finger Lakes. Which is, I think this is a really interesting change.
Yeah. And it's, again, like we could talk about how he made this wine, which was very hard to find the information on, but we tracked it down. But this is Nathan Kay, up in, I think most of the grapes are coming from around the Seneca Lake. And he really just makes like Riesling, Pinot Noir, Little Cab Franc, maybe some Chardonnay sometimes, but everything he does is in neutral barrel, as far as I can tell. Everything is done with long lees contact, and everything is released a little bit later than you might expect. So this is certainly the case with this rosé, where he's, I think, doing 4 months on the gross lees, all in neutral barrel.
I think all lees are gross, man.
Can I just ask to kind of calibrate myself what we're looking at by way of like additions to these wines?
Very good question.
Wine number one's organic, and it might actually be
It's not sans souffle. I think it was like 15 parts per million added. I found the raw wine profile. So it's
got to be below.
Yeah, it has a MasterCard.
This we know sulfur-wise is 30. They do like the 35 free sulfites, but it's like 70 total, I think. In terms of farming, it's a little vague. It says no herbicides and no pesticides and nothing else.
Mm-hmm. It's like the Finger Lakes are really weird. Like, does it say anything about fungicides? That's the thing in the Finger Lakes, because it gets fucking shroomy. It's so wet and gross.
But yeah, there's not a lot of... I think we finally got a text sheet that said which vineyard this was coming from. Mm-hmm. But so Nathan is buying grapes. He comes from a winemaking family. He's made wine in a lot of other places. He came back to the Finger Lakes specifically to make minimal intervention wine. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, like, there's not a ton of information on his website about the kind of process, other than neutral barrel for everything, Lee's contact, and then minimal intervention, which you can kind of, I guess, interpret as you want.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he gets a lot of kind of purchase because he works with Pascaline on her project as well. So he definitely gets, I think, like most of us, you're like, oh, well, if Pascaline vouches for you, then I guess probably you're not really fucking this up. But
she subscribes to our Patreon, interestingly enough. So, and this is true. So if you want to be like Pascaline, it's patreon.com/disgorgeous, and you can get the info that every day guides her. It's like the plan that Joe Biden gets on his desk every day about, you know, the world history that he does not read because he cannot read. But it is like that with wine, and you can read it and you can learn. So it's patreon.com/disgorgeous. And with that, you can your mind will become so sharp that if you were to meet Pascaline, you could cut her with it.
Wow.
Yes.
Not that you would.
Please don't cut Pascaline. We need her.
Please do not.
We need her, but you know, if you can defeat her in a contest of wills with our help, that's kind of exciting.
You're gonna need a lot of help. Yeah, I mean, this is such a such a U-turn from the last wine in almost every way.
I found one of the articles I found about this wine. He says he's not making this again. Like, this was like his one time making this wine. And reading between the lines, it seems like this wine was not the critical success it needs to be. Which is not to say anything about the wine, but I don't think the wine caught on. It is extremely fucking weird. The Finger Lakes is really basic in a lot of times, like in the palate. And like, I can see this not going over gangbusters in a Finger Lakes tasting room. I Googled where his wine... So he worked with his parents' winery, Hickory Hollow, and they say on their website, we're not accepting tour buses due to COVID-19, which makes me think that tour buses would go there normally. Mm-hmm. And this does not taste like a tour bus wine. Right. This tastes like the kind of wine that you would find in 2015, like at Frankly Wines. And Christy would be like screaming at you, like, you trust me, this wine is really good. And you'd bring it home and have your it'd knock you on your ass. But it's not like a tour bus of people looking for rosés in the Finger Lakes in August might find this to be a little weird.
Yeah.
Does he only have like his line and then the stuff that he does with Pascaline? Because I can't imagine, like, I've sold quite a few of his wines. I can't imagine that. They're delicious, but that any of them are necessarily what, like, a mass bus.
No, I think he is the winemaker for Hickory Farms. Is that
Hickory Hollow?
Hickory Hollow, his parents' winery. So he makes the wine there. Okay. I think his mom worked for Herman Weimer.
Mm-hmm.
Weimer.
And, friend of the pod.
And so, he's sort of, I wouldn't say his Finger Lakes royalty, but he's certainly like of the wine scene there. And his brother's also a winemaker in Oregon. So he's from this family. I think that it reads passion project to me.
Mm-hmm. It tastes passion project too. This is kind of fuck juice. I love reduction. Reduction's like, because like you have to slow down a little bit, so like you start thinking about other things, you know.
Right there. Girl, this tastes like fuck juice. You know, like, I grabbed a piece of goat. So I'm a pescatarian. I've been a pescatarian since I'm 15. So roughly 15 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm very sensitive to reduction in that everything tastes like bologna. Mm-hmm. But what I've learned from watching people eat so much charcuterie is like Bologna loves goat cheese. Mm-hmm. And when I get some wines that have a little bit of reduction in them, mm-hmm, yeah, and I pair it with goat cheese, some tend to be delicious. And that just kind of happened with this. I was smelling it. I'm like, oh, this is a little meaty, but mm-hmm, I also get a little bit of like a rounded out kind of sour terry thing going on. Like I can get past this. And I have the goat cheese here with me, and it's delicious.
Do you have the bloodlust? Are you like that kind of pescatarian, or are you just like straight up do not want to eat meat?
I do not want to eat meat.
I extremely mentally do not want to eat it. I have to keep myself from getting hungry enough, because if I smell like an animal being cooked, it's just like.
I mean, I'll cook a thick tuna steak when I'm feeling. For me, it's texture. It's okay. Not so much like bloodlust. It's not like the scent and stuff. I just sometimes miss sinking my teeth into something. At which case, I'll cook up some tuna or some swordfish, or
some jackfruit.
Thick. You know what I mean? A little jackfruit, a little thick ass mushroom. But
cauliflower steak, baby.
I mean, say what you will. Texture is everything to me.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I love the discussion of texture, because this wine.
Yeah.
I'm obsessed with this fucking thing that people use. There's this one experiment that some stupid university did like 3 decades ago that people always bring up to discredit wine people, yeah, which is that trained sommeliers can't distinguish red and white wine if the wine's in a paper bag or something.
Yeah, I think it was. I have a friend who did this to me, and he told me it was out of a sippy cup.
Okay.
That they put wine in baby sippy cups, and then mm-hmm, a sommelier couldn't tell if it was a red or a white or something, as if that's like a cool trick.
And yeah. I'm just obsessed with the idea of, could I tell wines apart without, like, it's like, yeah, I guess if you took away two of my fucking senses, it'd be hard for me to do this. But like, I mean, this wine does not feel like a rosé in my mouth. Like it feels kind of like a red wine, except there's also, heavy. It's lacking something. It's, I probably would have called it an orange perhaps, mm-hmm, which is what's the difference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's got that heavy, like the Mallow and the Lees are like weighing, mm-hmm, like, you know, like Ebenezer Scrooge, like the chains on, mm-hmm, what's his friend's name? I guess they weren't
Marlo
friends anymore. Yeah, Marlo, mm-hmm, his enemy, whatever. It's like those chains dragging behind it. It's just like a little bit heavy.
It's a chungus. It's a chungus of a wine.
But to get back to like this idea of, I think, John, that you were mentioning, like, if I had to sell this as a, like, this rosé, mm-hmm, it would not be, I would have to think about who I was going to bring it to. Mm-hmm. I would have to know that we had previously had a conversation that, like, oh, I actually like kind of, like, heavier, like, meaty, kind of rich rosés. I kind of have a thing for those. Because the person I sell it to is going to have to work really hard to sell it to their customers too. Like, it's going to have to be a hand sell at some point. Like, and it's and more so than I think any other category of wine, including orange wine, because it's having this moment. I think people can just say, this is orange and it's $13 and you can, mm-hmm, have it and people will buy it. And I think people know what they like with red, they know what they like with white wines, but they can be kind of convinced that they'll like something new. And people get very myopic and very like laser focus with what they like from rosé, as they just do. And it's such a unique challenge in selling wine is trying to sell an outside the box rosé in my mind.
And this one's also doubly cursed because it's actually quite affordable. Mm-hmm. I believe it's $17. And just a little bit of the making the sausage experiment. I don't know if it's $17 cost or $17 at the store. This was our good friends at Vine Wine. Helped me source some wine, and they just told me how much I owed them. Either way, it's the cheapest wine we've had in the podcast for about 3 months. Mm-hmm. And it's really fucking good, especially when you realize like every other wine we have in this fucking show is like mid-30s at least. Mm.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I'm going to go back to it. I'll always go back to it. It's my favorite part of wine. Things get a lot easier when you can throw some food in front of it. Mm-hmm. Like we think of wine, I mean, not all of us, but like we're sitting here, we're taking apart the wine, we're talking about it as if it's always just going to be in this glass. And mm-hmm, the way that we drink is interacting with other things, interacting with food, interacting with music, interacting with people in normal circumstances, whatever. And this has a lot of energy and a lot of kind of like things poking out. But when you combine it with something else, they may be sources of, like, mm-hmm, connection. You know what I mean? Which is, it's just beautiful.
I will also, I guess I keep bringing up the cynical point of view, but with rosé is also the wine that is least likely in my mind to be consumed with food. Yeah. If you are going, you're buying rosé because you're going to sit by the pool, or you're buying rosé because you're going to the beach. You're buying rosé because you're going to drink it before you go out to dinner. You know what I mean? It has this sort of, maybe champagne is, well, champagne gets paired with food all the fucking time. But like,
but everyone rosé, acts like they're doing a favor. Like, hey, we're going to pair champagne.
Yeah. But
with
like,
shrimp.
But like rosé, I think in this very unique way is always considered to be, you know, an aperitif, like a before the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're absolutely right, but we need to change this perception of like, this is what rosé is, because it should be paired with food. It absolutely should be, especially if it's like this and it's this old and it's this complex. Because it's not just cold juice.
No, that's like the idea of, so like the economics of making like a rosé, because like so many good winemakers also make a trash rosé. Like they make a rosé for the category, and like that must be maybe it's a fun challenge to be like, hey, can I, a guy who normally makes pretty good wine, make a rosé for $15 that's inoffensive? Because it seems like so many winemakers I know do this, which is just like, good, and this is the rosé. We also make a rosé. And like, I, you know, this thing we've been kind of probing into, especially with our domestic season we just recently did, but like, you need to have ready money at hand for a winery. And like, rosé oftentimes is like, well, we have young vines. Mm-hmm. We're either going to make a bad Pet Nat or an okay rosé out of it. What would you prefer? When people take the time and put like good grapes and like make a rosé, it really says something, because like, you know, I'm here, I'm already tasting your expensive wines. I guess I'll buy a case of your fucking rosé too. Like, why not? Yeah, that's a business model.
Mm. Do you guys have a similar experience with people starting to ask for deeper, darker, more savory rosés? Is that a question that you're starting to kind of field more often?
I would say yes.
Did like one case.
But more very recently. Mm-hmm. And I think it has to do with people drinking more orange wine.
Mm.
Where I think it's changed people's perception a little bit. Like the conversation of like, what is wine color and why is it that way? Mm-hmm. Is happening in more people's brains than were happening before, where it was, there's red, there's white, there's rosé. And the fact that a whole new, quote unquote, I'm using air quotes, kind of wine was invented.
Mm-hmm.
As some people think, like 10 years ago, like orange wine appeared out of nowhere, and people are like, you can have a new kind of color. And we had to be like, well, no, it's not new. It's been around mm-hmm. for a long time. And the color of wine is a spectrum. And why is it orange? And it's orange because it's sort of like the reverse of a rosé. It started to let people know that rosé also is on this spectrum. And so I think that's driven a little bit of people being like, oh, I kind of like a darker rosé, or maybe I like a rosé with like a little bit of RS to it. Like there's a pendulum swing happening that way, I think. Have you noticed that? That was
I had a joke. You should answer the question. My joke wasn't funny.
Yes, but I think part of that is that I've been crazy about deep, dark, savory rosés for a couple seasons now. I think a lot of my peers in the industry
mm-hmm.
have been too. I think some of that is driven by a push of co-ferments.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, yes.
Put a pin in that. Yes, push for co-ferments. But also, just as we were kind of mentioning before, like a Terrasuolo di Abruzzo mm-hmm. is fucking fantastic. And when you drink those, you're like, whoa, where else are they doing things like this? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, where else can I get this? It's again, it's that texture, but also with that kind of like transparency of terroir, because not too many rosés are aged in oak, not mm-hmm. too many yeah. sea oak. And I'm somebody that really appreciates, for lack of a better word, like varietal purity. I love concrete.
Mm-hmm.
I love acacia. I love these things that just seem to really amp up the mm-hmm. aromatics, but keep the palate really identifiable. Mm-hmm. And you find that a lot in rosés.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that not only do I see like buyers kind of ask for it, I think I push for it a little bit. Yeah. I also think that it happens to be really, really good with vegetables. Like if I'm thinking of vegetarian food, vegetarian cuisine, whatever, like pick a region, rosés will make that pop. Rosés will pick up on those umami notes. Rosé, I don't know. It's just maybe it's the lees. Maybe it's the lees that's present in some of these deeper, darker rosés, but like they do really well with food.
I think you also nailed something there where it's like when you're a sales rep and you have a thing that you really, this becomes kind of like the bee in your bonnet that you want to talk about a lot. When it becomes time for those buyers that they actually are looking for that thing, they think of you for it, you know, where they're like, oh, right, Kevin's always talking about whatever I'm talking about. And it's like,
me. I should call, talking about John.
I should call him because I now finally need that. You know what I mean? And so, like, that's part of it too, where like you're always kind of casting your line out a little bit. And then sometimes you get that bite. But I think also you're right. I think there is like, there is a desire for something new in general, I think. I think, like, I mean, look, I mentioned before how many different iterations rosé has gone through, but you think about Bandol or you think about, like, Close to Bone. Like, there have been, like, really big, like, popular, even if in a niche kind of way, oaked rosés in the world or rosés that you age for a while.
There's nothing new, like, ever.
But then people drifted so far to this, you know, Yes Way Rosé or whatever, the Whispering Angel kind of vibe, and people want to move the other way back. You know,
we were so close for this episode, by the way. I was trying to source White Girl Rosé from 2015. I had this really good idea of us doing bad rosé with too many vintages on it.
Yeah.
And I talked myself out of it because I realized I'd have to do it.
Yeah.
But if there was a way I could do this podcast without being there, just presenting the wines, it would have been like Summer Water, Whispering Angel, White Girl Rosé from like six vintages ago. I was been like, let them cook. Let's see what happens.
Can I be mean for a quick second? And
to
then
me?
We can be good again. Not to anybody. Well, to Martha Stewart. Is that allowed?
Not too mean. She's like the only Protestant I like.
Okay, cool. I'm just going to be mean to her website, not to her. Okay. She had an article that was like, what's the deal with aging rosé? And it was sort of infuriating. I'm just going to read one paragraph of it. How long will that bottle of rosé last unopened? Perhaps not as long as white wine. The explanation why. White rosé is typically understood as a white wine. It's usually never oaked like a white.
What?
So a white has more time to age than a rosé. And there are other aspects that blah, blah, blah. And
well, Martha smokes weed now.
At the end, it says that if you buy a natural rosé, it'll only last for 3 to 6 months.
It's a Martha Stewart strain of weed.
Yeah.
Martha Stewart's like, she's in the kitchen cooking.
But it's going to be in the houseplant, Seth Rogen.
I'm so glad Zwan is in the background of this episode. It's my favorite part of this episode.
It makes you want to clean the house. Martha Stewart's strain of weed.
Yeah.
That is
my nightmare weed, by the way. That's the exact opposite of I want weed to do for me.
I love high-functioning weed where you get it and it's like, yeah, I'm going to look at some facts about cats on the internet.
When I smoke that kind of weed, I just like sit and think about every dumb thing I ever said in front of somebody.
Couldn't be me.
It's not good.
I'm on to wine number three, which is, for a second, I thought you had maybe like put like a coconut curry in here. And then I was like, oh no, that's the fucking wine. It's really spicy. Oh,
are you smelling it out of the glass jar I gave you?
Yes.
You might be smelling coconut curry. Okay,
the wine tastes like it. I like it though. Well, do you guys smell the coconut curry?
No, I like coconut oil. I like the coconut oil note.
I actually do get a coconutty thing. Not curry, but I get like that coconut, like a coconut juice or coconut water, some kind of thing.
I've been very sensitive to like oil lately and very slick varietals. I don't know what's going on, but like it's like almost coming through the bouquet where I'm like, ooh, this is gonna be slick. I'm picking up on a lot of like young coconut vibes kind of thing. And I eat a lot of coconuts. I drink a lot of coconut water. It might just be like that thing. But this wine is throwing it all over the place.
This wine is Really fun. Can you tell us a little bit about the producer?
Yeah. So this is Darichi coming out of the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon. Mm-hmm.
I tasted their wines on our Lebanese episode that Kevin was having a baby during.
Not literally in the moment, and I wasn't doing the hard work, but yeah.
You did some work.
We have, you know, Abdul working on this project. He's a Syrian refugee in Lebanon. He was working basically on a picking crew and just has this affinity for low intervention winemaking. Like, he's like a savant. He was working with a farming co-op essentially that works in conjunction with a winery that like exclusively buys and sources these grapes from this co-op that is working on converted hashish fields. So
big mistake.
So we have this wine that is really helping to stabilize the economy of this region, because as much as it's kind of like passe, hash growing is still illegal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when the feds decide to crash, your harvest is done. your money for that year is done. So, I mean, there's some co-planting and stuff like that, but that's kind of that project down there. Abdul is working in conjunction with Ayushimi, who, you know, just opened Marcel winery up at some pretty high altitudes, working with some indigenous grape varietals that were
absolute king.
Super, super fucking excited to work with once they can get out of port.
He said he's mailing me stuff as well, so I'm excited.
I mean, we'll see when he can get his own stuff. You know what I mean? Like, it's this you know, global logistics are kind of crazy right now. But this is 100% Syrah, which, you know, lends itself to that kind of slick, the slick that we're picking up. Indigenous yeasts were you know, when I first saw the tech sheets and things, and when I was first kind of getting acclimated with the portfolio, I'm like, all right, what's this traditional vinification? Are you saying like conventional? Like, what is this traditional? It's like traditional to our region, which is native yeast fermentation, which is limited stabilization, which is real fucking wine. So it's, yeah, it's traditional. I'm like, okay, I'm with it. Heard, like, that's what we're doing. So that's how this rosé was vinified coming out of the Bekaa Valley. Also really worth noting, the Bekaa Valley was terraced when the Romans first colonized it. And they also chose to build their temple to Bacchus in the Bekaa Valley, not in Italy, not in France, but in this area. It is a biblical, fertile area. And so with global warming, this area is kind of getting hot, and we have people that are being driven up into altitude. So we're now going to see some different expressions coming out of Lebanon, some different grapes that are able to grow at higher altitudes. And I'm just super excited about it. So yeah, the Lebanese conversation is really inspiring, and it's really thrilling to watch a region develop on its own in real time with little outside influence.
Wine from this region, they have found hieroglyphs attesting to this in both of the scorpion kings from the Egyptian Zeroth dynasty. No, Kevin. Kevin, read a goddamn book about ancient Egypt for once.
Yeah, I read the novelization of the movie The Scorpion King.
I really want to watch that movie. I actually want to watch all the Mummy movies. I got to get like incredibly high. Like the kind of high where I can't have my phone, cuz I will look at like a frog picture. Yeah, Martha Stewart high. I'm listening to Tides of History. I don't know if you guys listen to Tides of History. It's historian who I keep on DMing trying to get him to come on the podcast. He has not responded or seen them yet, but he will one day. And he just did a really good episode about the rise of pharaonic Egypt. So if you have 56 minutes exactly, you guys should turn off this stupid podcast and listen to that one. They're our sponsor.
To go back to this wine.
Don't go back to this wine, Kevin. Answer the query. Are you going to listen to it?
No. To go back to this wine, that sort of coconut note and that coconut oil idea has sort of morphed into like, do you remember those like ice pops? They were like maybe like Edie's Ice Pops or something. And they had a coconut one and a strawberry one. They were like real fruit. I remember you get them at like.
I remember the real fruit. Like, and you could have the crunchy strawberries in there.
And they had inside of them, yeah. Mm-hmm. This is giving me some kind of like a cross of the coconut one and the strawberry. Like there's a little bit of like that, mm-hmm. The flavor like a strawberry gives, not fresh, but when it's frozen, that's like. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a death flavor. It's not a death flavor, but it's like the flavor fruit gives when it's frozen or freeze dried, as opposed to fresh.
I was thinking the Special K with strawberries, yeah. The limited edition, exactly. Like that weird, like yeah. it's the ghost of a strawberry. Exactly. It's the idea of it's a strawberry it's turned strawberry into a symbol
at all. But it's like yeah, it's like the what's left of a strawberry after the strawberry is removed. It's yeah, it's cool.
It's the strawberry's caw. You know, the caw is the horse-headed spirit, and the ba is the part that stays with the body. Unless I got those mixed up, in which case I was doing it as a joke.
Okay, John, come through with the Egyptian references. That is Egyptian, yeah? We're
still Egyptian? Okay. That's all I think about. a D-dye. All day I dream about Egypt. So I love this.
Can we pivot here maybe to talk about like the Knit Wine Project and what exactly – how that works? That it's like an umbrella kind of a grouping of different mm-hmm. books, right?
Yeah, for sure. So it really came together in the name of market efficiencies. Mm-hmm. Like when you're dealing with micro portfolios, when you're dealing with importers – that are taking the time to really hone in and specialize on a specific region mm-hmm. And make a whole book out of it. When you are dealing with smaller businesses, it's like, all right, great. But like, I can't buy 5 cases of Hungarian wine. Mm-hmm. I can't make a $500 minimum of Greek wine. Like mm-hmm. I don't have the space for it. So it was posing problems, you know what I mean? And you don't want to water down the situation. Like Eclecticon, it's a natural Greek book. It's the first, natural leaning book to come out of Greece, period. Yeah. To add other countries to that in order to like grow your orders would just dilute the whole conversation. And quite mm-hmm. frankly, like he doesn't want to import shit from other areas. That's not what he's interested in. Yeah. We have the same, you know, so it's Eclecticon, Danchin Granger, which is essentially doing the same thing out of Central and Eastern Europe. Eric is the former buyer, Hungarian buyer for Blue Danube. Mm-hmm. We also have Tarasankta, mm-hmm. which is working with Palestine and Lebanon.
Wonderful.
And then
do they do an Iraq as well?
Yes. So it's Tarasankta wine, beer, and Iraq.
Okay, cool.
Cool.
Rep in the Holy Land. And then we also have the Maritime Republic, Chris Leo. Mm-hmm. And he really specializes in Central Italian wine. And it's interesting. His story is that he found quite a bit of fame as a musician in Italy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was in La Marche. He was in Lazio. He was in Calabria. That's where his peoples were at. And he fell in love with a couple of producers and he wanted to bring them in. So that's his book. And we're also going to be bringing in wines from Hootenanny, Summer Wolf, beginning in April.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. So she, you know, Italian wine specialist, a little bit in Austria, a little bit in Slovenia. So all of these really incredibly focused and quite frankly, expertly sourced books coming together as a collective, sharing a rep, being able to kind of layer on top of each other to make minimums and also in the name of like maintaining relationships, you know, mm-hmm. Kind of knitting the conversation together. And I should also mention that I'll be curating a domestic book for Knit, really concentrating on underrepresented communities and underrepresented regions within the domestic conversation. And we'll be premiering our first producer, Ashanta, in April. I'm really excited about that.
Wow. Yes. Will you remind us if we forget that we should probably taste that wine?
Oh, hell yeah. Okay. Super limited. She is working.
Now I want it more. Fuck, you're good at this.
She was mentored by Tony Couturier and Caleb.
I'll take a case. Cool.
And she is just, her story is fucking brilliant. Her grandfather was Sicilian and planted the family vineyard. And when it was mm-hmm. kind of tore up in 2017 by the fire, she was really inspired to just reconnect with her grandfather. By kind of reviving these vineyards. She wanted to travel to Sicily. But she was, you know, travels restricted, and she's just made this really dope and cared for project. I'm really excited to share her wines with people.
Exciting. Yeah, that's awesome. I think this is cool. This is sort of an interesting way to maybe wrap up this conversation, because some things I've been thinking about throughout this pandemic is like how, you know, I mean, it was happening before the pandemic with all the tariffs that were coming through, like the effect on smaller books that like just keep getting squashed by reality over and over again. And like, when you don't have that ability to pick, oh, well, I'll just pick up a Pinot Grigio and sell 100 cases of it, or I'll just pick up a, you know, a simple rosé that tastes like water and that'll pay for the stuff I care about. Sometimes that's not an option, or you don't want that to be the option. You want to be able to continue to do what you care about. And I've been thinking a lot about through the pandemic, like there's been a lot of bad news, but the good news that has come out has always been stories of like people in communities binding together to do something together.
Yeah.
And when I am feeling a lot of despair, that's what I try to think about as the positive thing to make me feel better. And I think that's sort of exciting, like that you guys have come together and created this idea to support each other in a way where no one has to sell out their ideals to survive in a pretty bloodthirsty fucking environment, which the wine world is, no matter how you cut it.
Have you seen Three Ninjas?
Of course. Oh, you're asking me? You know I've seen it.
Jade, have you seen Three Ninjas?
I don't believe so.
The idea is there's three ninjas, and they're children. And I'm pretty sure this is from there. They get a stick, and it breaks easily. And they get three sticks, and it's hard to break those sticks.
Yes.
You should maybe – I don't know what role you are for the HR of Knitwine, but you should get everyone to watch Three Ninjas – and then the sequel, which I'm pretty sure is Three Ninjas Strikes Back.
It's okay. There's Three Ninjas Kickback.
Kickback. I'm so fucking sorry, Kevin.
And then there's also Three Ninjas Punch Up.
Which is that the surf one? Is there one that's a surf one?
That's Surf Ninjas, which is technically unrelated.
I'm sorry, Kevin.
I know the whole ninja oeuvre of the early
my twin, to mid-90s. My twin and I used to watch a lot of the Three Ninjas movies.
Yeah.
Birthday. Oh my God, what an asshole.
Thank you. Finally, happy fucking birthday. Someone said happy it. You are birthday. An asshole. Happy birthday to me. Yeah.
Don't say
Pisces
that.
Pisces boys, stay winning. It's great. I went to the graveyard.
I'm sorry. I really meant to open with that.
No, you can't say nice things to him at the beginning.
We haven't started recording yet. This is just we've just been like shooting the shit. So let's go. Press record, say happy birthday. Let's go.
I really appreciate that you, I mean, for me, this past year would have been shit without community. And I found myself wrapped up in community, which I don't think I've ever participated in fully, like in my life. I've always been kind of like a contrarian.
It doesn't jive with what I'm seeing here, but it is.
I found my happy place though. And now like I'm here, you know, and it's great to find other people that share my ideals and share my morality and just share my general passion. And it feels really great. But on the opposite side of that, and really as it like applies to Knit, not only are we in community with each other, but these importers are in community with the areas and the regions that they represent. As I'm tasting through Danchen Granger and as we're tasting through these Serbian wines, he's telling me how these wines are funding fucking community centers. He's telling me how these areas have not recovered and have just been abandoned after the war, and how it's up to these people to build up their own communities, and they're using their vineyards and their wines to do so. I'm going to sell the shit out of that wine.
Yes, you might. I'm getting my buying urge right here.
Out of that. Yeah, so... I mean, not even to come at it from like that really thin, you know, view of capitalism, but it's just so much motivation behind it. And it really, like, this is a hard job. People see the podcast, they see this, they see the glamour. It sucks. We're pouring wine into like plastic containers on the side of the street in 20 degree weather today, you know?
It's very romantic.
But I'd love to.
When
to
you
do
get
it.
To tell the stories, some of these backstories of people who are really like using this thing that we love in order to better
this thing of ours
life, it's motivation, and like that's why I'm here, and like we can laugh and we can keep it light, but at the end of the day this is some really impactful shit. And I'm really grateful to have found a place where I can kind of fit in and do it all in one, you know.
Absolutely. And to tie that just a little bit into the theme of the day, like I kept bringing up these sort of the cynical reality of like the business of rosé, but I think the point I'm trying to make was to create like what we're fighting against, whatever, like what you can ignore, what you have the ability to, if you choose to ignore and look into actual wine. This is just wine made by people with less skin contact than the other wine they make. That's all it fucking
it's
is.
It's just a fucking wine.
It's just a fucking wine.
Wine
just
is wine.
Just drink it. And it, if it's, you know, a reductive, weird-ass wine from the Finger Lakes, like, buy it and wait 3 years, and it'll get cool, and it'll be delicious, and you'll love it. Like, this is what, this is
you
the conversation.
You should buy everything I sell you and wait 3 years, to be honest. That's like, if you're listening to this and you're on the fence about buying wine for me, especially the allocated ones, buy and wait 3 years. Don't worry about it.
At any rate, I guess that's like, my idea is like, sometimes good things are worth seeking out and working for, you know.
It's so beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm a father now, so these things just come to me.
Well, I think this is a great spot to end. I would suggest that everyone does follow our guest on Instagram, because you've been like fucking popping off, and like it's been great, and you've also been doing a lot of great Instagram lives. Kevin and I were actually talking about this before, not in like a weird way, but we were talking about like you seem to have cracked the code of like selling wine in the pandemic, which is like you've been like drinking bottles and like doing Instagram lives in a way that doesn't suck, which is hard to do. And like
we tried to do it for a while and it sucked and we stopped.
You can compare your output to like our output and be like, oh fuck, okay.
But here I am on your platform. Thank you so much for sharing. You guys are awesome. Thank you.
You're awesome.
Yeah, you'll get an email in 4 years from us like, hey, can we come on your platform, please? We need to sell some Pinot Grigio real fucking bad, please.
Remember that time we blacked out and gave you good advice by accident at Pitch?
Accidentally.
It does.
This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Is there anything else you want to plug before we go?
Swan's the shit. That's
yeah,
all.
That's all. We love Swan. Yeah.
Swan rules.
Swan, you want to come back on soon?
No, I mean, real quick, I think that it's really important, you know, for us on the supply chain to take responsibility for what it is that we put ourselves behind. And at the end of the day, we're in a very privileged position to be able to work for something and work with something that we're so passionate about. And it's a big old fucking industry. And if you run into some issues where your morals do not align with the products that you are pushing, you do not have to push them anymore. You don't have to choose one or the other. And I think that's something that we all just kind of have to take ownership of and accountability of. And I'll just leave that there.
Love it.
Woo.
That's it. That's it.
Dade Marley drinks.
We got the Zwan standing ovation. That's about as good as you can do on this.
We honestly didn't get that. We did not get that when she was on our episode. She she was so cold to us.
Malvasia had a good time. Come on.
That's true.
We had a great fucking time.
How can you not with Malvasia?
In my mind, that was the last normal episode before the pandemic. But I think there was a couple others.
Yeah.
Well, I have to drink old Burgundy now. This has been fun, but it's time for my real work. That's onlyfans.com/duckfromdisgorgeous to see my Burgundy set, and it's powerfully erotic. Thank you so much for being on our podcast.
This is Sistrin. This is inner community energy
network. Amongst ourselves, and I love it.
We got to do it.
This is probably the least productive networking you're doing today, but I do love
it. All right, bye guys. Thank you so much.
Bye. We love you.
We love you guys.
Swan's Wine Club.
Oh yeah, hell yeah! Sign up for Swan's Wine Club. That's absolutely true.
Send us a link. We'll put it on the thing.
Gotta get it together.
Mm-hmm.
Right. None of Kevin's wine's on it, though. Bye.
Bye.
Disgorgeous.